So, it's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always, it's time for Office Hour. Before we begin, you're listening to 90.3 FM, KDVS. And before we start our show, we always remind you that the views that are contained in this hour, they may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So, it's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always, it's time for Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And as we do on Tuesdays, we're going to go out into the campus and knock on someone's door and find out something that someone's doing on campus, some kind of interesting research, and ask the question, what are these professors doing hidden away in their offices? What are they working on? What are they thinking about? What do they do all day long? So here we go. You can hear us knocking. And I'm very excited. Today we are knocking on a door in the English department. But don't think we're going to be doing what I would call standard English. It's the English department isn't what it used to be when I was in college now. So we have today Parma Roy from the English department. So I want to welcome you. Welcome to Office Hour.
Thank you, Naomi. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Okay. And we're going to be continuing actually a theme where we've been talking about diasporic literature, and also people in diaspora studying homeland literature. We talked about Nigerian, we talked about Persian, and this week we're going to be talking about literature related to India and food, which is a great thing to talk about in the hour before dinner, right?
Indeed. Or at any time.
At any time, exactly. So if you weren't ready for dinner, you will be ready by the end of the show. So hang in there. But before we start on her particular research, we're always interested in how is it that people commit themselves to large parts of their lives to studying whatever it is that they pick, in this case, to be writing about comparative literature or literature within the context of an English department, in this case, literature about India. So how did you become interested in this field broadly and then in the particular studies that we're going to be talking about today? Tell us how you got here today.
Right. Well, I don't know that I have a particularly inspiring answer. Really, I would say I do this because it was the only thing I was good at, you know, and so it seemed like a reasonable way to make a living. I was trained many years ago when dinosaurs walked the earth as a Victorianist, a student of the British 19th century, and that is still one of the hats that I wear. Mm-hmm. And I turned to that. One reason I turned to that was because the novels were so superbly long. And yes, it always seemed to me to be an extraordinary bonus to walk in, you know, into a library and get, you know, an 800 or 900 page novel to bring back home with you. Right. So that's one of the great inducements. And so I was trained as a Victorianist, but over the course of my graduate career and as well as my early academic career, I came to be interested in a field that was just forming, which is now called postcolonial studies, which was a study of Britain in the broader context of its empire, right? So Britain in a sort of larger global context rather than a narrowly parochial context, right? And so I was interested first in Victorian literature, and then those interests expanded to British as well as British imperial literatures, right? And I, you know, became interested in food many years ago when I wanted to think about some of the complexities of what we call encounters with difference, or the colonial encounter, or encounters with otherness, right?
Well, there's a couple interesting points in there. I just want to stop and pause. First of all, I hope that my students are listening to someone discuss the pleasure of coming back from the library with an 800-page novel. Okay, that was described as a pleasure and not as a burden. Okay, out there,
no sense of irony in that at all.
Absolutely, all those big fat. We were sad. I grew up reading those with my sister, those giant novels, and it was tremendous mourning at the end because you had gotten so invested in everybody's lives.
Indeed.
By the end of the 800 pages, you felt like you had lost a great deal, a whole world. The other point which I thought was fascinating and also is kind of interesting for students to think about, as everybody, is what you're good at. So are you saying that you were good at reading really big novels and that somehow you said this was the only thing you were good at? I was kind of curious what exactly you were, because not everybody could read. Because it's a fairly hefty commitment to study Victorian literature.
Yeah. Well, I was good at reading and writing. I mean, both things of great length, but also reading with a certain kind of minuteness, right? Which is what literary study is about, which is about a certain kind of examination of detail at a certain level of minuteness and intensity. It's what we call close reading, right?
Right.
And so, so the field seemed to me to nicely combine this kind of macroscopic dimension, so these large multi-plot novels, you know, which went on for hundreds of pages, which were involved in world making, you know, with very elaborate forms of world making in just fascinating ways. But you could combine it with this sort of extraordinarily fine-grained attention to the small detail. So mm-hmm. I liked the kind of stereoscopic approach that the field allowed.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to point out that this love of close reading and love of certain types of literature and not feeling daunted about just throwing yourself into this field and that you would...
No,
that,
it was a pleasure.
And that there would be a future for you in this field. So I think that's also very interesting. The one other...
One throws oneself into things sometimes as a matter of faith. One is not... You know, guaranteed. There's no guarantee that there will be a job at the end of it. But sometimes you do it, you know, in a state of half knowledge of what lies ahead, but you do it anyway.
Right. And you do it because it's meaningful to you.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that's a very optimistic and in many ways a very lovely story. I really appreciated that. I'm curious because we've been talking a lot and we'll be talking today about diaspora and homeland. How do you see yourself, and just in terms of your personal story, were you always a diaspora, or have you always been looking at Indian literature from living abroad, or what, in terms of your own life story, how do you position yourself in relationship? Because you're starting with Victorian literature, so I'm just curious how that... we're all diaspora when it comes to Victorian literature, right? Because none of us lived in the homeland of Victorian literature.
Right. A truer word was never spoken. Yeah. I mean, one accidental reason that I'm interested in India is, you know, the contingency of birth, right?
Right.
So I grew up there. I went to college there and then came to the United States to do my doctoral work. But there is a very real sense in which one simply cannot assume that, one knows something because one presumably
Absolutely.
Comes from a certain place. Everything has to be learned. You have to do your homework about everything. And perhaps you have to do your homework much more scrupulously because you think you're from somewhere, right? And so, as you say, I mean, we are all foreigners to what we study, whether it is a place that you supposedly come from, whether it is an earlier historical period that you study, and they both demand both a certain kind of intensive homework, but also a certain kind of distancing, if you
right.
will.
Right, exactly. So in your case, to sort of your way of relating to the literature and the study we're going to be talking about today, as you said, was through food. So food becomes a way of traveling. It's almost as if you use food as a way of traveling to this literature and both making it familiar and unfamiliar.
Right.
And I realize this is a good campus to do food, right?
It's an excellent campus.
There's
to
a lot
do
of food on campus
indeed,
in one
indeed.
Form or the other.
Yeah.
Though I was just hearing today my students once again complaining about the food in the dining hall.
Well,
but
that's another matter.
That's another matter. But the whole image. So maybe we want to move into this through this question of why is it that food is such a good way to travel into literature? I suppose one way to start, which I think is true for all of our listeners, eat, right? Everybody out there eats. So everybody has experiences with food.
Mm-hmm,
do
mm-hmm.
you think that's sort of the place to start as we begin to think about food? Why is food such a good way of thinking about literature?
Yeah, well, there is something absolutely basic and absolutely primal about food, but I also wanted to think about food precisely because of its banality, the ways in which it animates our lives, our everyday lives, but we so often look through it, right, without thinking of the ways in which it sustains us or fills our lives with meaning, the ways in which it gives our lives certain forms of meaning and ritual and structure and so on. Mm-hmm. And so it's both about the familiarity of food, but it's also about defamiliarizing it, you know, making it into something strange, as it were, so that we can see it anew.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very, very valuable endeavor because, as I said, everybody eats. But maybe because of the fact that everybody eats and we eat all the time, it's very hard to actually pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. And that's what you meant about it becomes like, who thinks about, we just go through the shopping with our shopping cart and we put stuff in the shopping cart. We sit down with a menu and we don't really think about how did we get to those particular things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and we talk about this in religious studies as well, to make the familiar strange so that we have the opportunity to see something a little bit more.
Right.
So we're immediately starting with the idea that everybody out there should be paying more attention to eating. Okay, so what are you eating? Did you think about what you ate? And in particular, what you're talking about is the way in which food shapes identity. Mm-hmm. And interacts with identity. So you mentioned two particular sort of loci of identity, one being the colonial modernity, that there's a way in which, and you said you're interested in post-colonial studies. Mm-hmm. So we live in a world in which that's a post-colonial world. We live in the world of modernity. And part of that, which we may not notice, you're arguing, is by what we eat.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is diaspora homeland, that there's a way in which we may not also be as aware about that.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two that you would say are most central to your work in terms of food.
Yes, I think that's probably a fair way of putting it. Yeah. And I would also say that a very important consideration for me, which I hope is manifest in the book, is the way in which food carries with it a certain kind of history. And food is also a very important theater for ethics, right? So I'd started by saying that food is one of the ways in which, is one of the important ways in which we engage with questions of identity, but also questions of difference, questions of otherness, and so on. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes actually a place where one can think about ethics in a really important way. So, you know, who eats with whom, who refuses to eat, who has access to food, what kinds of food do you refuse, etc. Mm-hmm. Right? These are all very deeply ethical questions.
I think that is a wonderful point because, as I always harp on with my students, ethics is sometimes presented as the famous trolley problem. And I always think that what are the chances that any of my students are going to be standing on it, you know, in front of a trolley that is barreling down, then they're, you know, the path, and they're going to have a choice of killing one person or five people and all those other things, which, you know, was developed at his time to sort of ask certain kinds of questions. But I think we run into ethics a lot more regularly on the plate.
Indeed.
Than we do in the trolley problem.
Right.
So we're
going
to try to think that through today by a couple examples of exactly how you say, how the ethics, the intersection between the ethics of food and identity of food through both colonial modernity and diaspora homeland. So you have a couple of different chapters, and we're, let's just, for people who want to run out and get this, alimentary tracts, appetite, aversions, and the post-colonial. So that's your book from Duke.
Yeah.
And we have four examples. And I thought we'd start today with the example of Gandhi, because I think many of our listeners are familiar with Gandhi and also familiar with the idea that food was a big issue with Gandhi, food, and that everybody knows a little bit about that. But I thought you really raised a lot of interesting and important new questions. I'm familiarized myself partly with Gandhi, as everybody does who teaches religion.
Right.
But I'd like to start with the point you make that food is very much connected to the family. Because I think that's another reason why food is so important that we often don't think about, but it is a very intimate and intimately connected with the family experience. Mm-hmm. So we think about Gandhi becoming vegetarian, for example, based on religious principles, but you really insist on saying there's also much closer things about the relationship between family and food. So I'd like to start off with that a little bit. How is it that, and I bet everybody out there is starting to free associate with things about family and food. What is it that, how do we see in his case, that intersection between the very intimate family situation and the sort of more general external, you know, taking up eating habits that you do in public?
Right. I think Gandhi is a very good figure to start with. And as you say, Gandhi is somebody who is famous, right, as a virtuoso of diet, or at least as a virtuoso of not eating, if you will, and of certain kinds of dietary practice, like a very carefully considered and principled vegetarianism, for example, but also a number of different fasts that he undertook over the course of his life. So he's famous for his fasting. And in many ways, then, Gandhi is seen, you know, commonly, but even by a lot of scholars, as this kind of heroic figure, right, of culinary abstinence, if you will, right? And he's seen almost as a certain kind of singular figure, right, in these forms of self-abnegation that he undertakes, for the cause of nationalism, for example, for the cause of, freedom from colonial rule, etc. But it seemed to me, when I looked at Gandhi's writing, his own writing, but also the writings of his associates, that he is seen, I think, more interestingly, more comprehensively, and more complexly as somebody who is not necessarily an isolated or singular figure, but somebody who must be placed, as you say, within the nexus of the family, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so part of what I'm doing in this chapter is, among other things, I think about the ways in which his dietary politics is part of a certain kind of anti-colonial drive, as it were. It's a kind of protest against what he sees as a British colonial order, which is marked by certain forms of inequality, by certain forms of overconsumption
and oppression,
oppression, etc. But that's an important dimension of what he's doing. But he is also, very importantly, a father and a husband, right?
And a son,
right? Who fasts and whose vegetarianism and whose fasting must be seen in relationship to the other members of his family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so Gandhi's autobiography, which is a very fascinating document for those of you who have not read it.
That's true.
Yeah. It's so much of it is orchestrated around food, right?
Yes.
And to the point that many of his admirers were completely frustrated by this. I mean, they kept wondering why he focused on something that seemed to them utterly trivial. It seemed to them cranky, faddish, peculiar, and frankly embarrassing.
And it took up a lot of pages.
It took up a lot of pages, right? So he keeps talking about all his experiments with diet, what he eats, what he does not eat, how many grapes, etc., etc., right? And so this was a very embarrassing part of his autobiography and his writings in general for, the people around him. But, part of the remit of my chapter is to demonstrate the ways in which this kind of attention to diet is part of a certain kind of larger politics, and it's part of a certain broader critique of colonialism. But as I was saying, part of it is also thinking about what it means to be a vegetarian patriarch,
right?
Which is what Gandhi was, right? And so it is not simply that he was refusing certain kinds of foods for himself. He was also, there are also all these incidents in the autobiography where you know, and this is a scene that seems to keep repeating over and over. It's a sort of continuing crisis, as it were. So his wife falls very, very ill. She's mm-hmm. undergone some kind of surgery and she's lost a lot of blood. And the doctors say, as late Victorian doctors always do, you have to give her eggs and you have to give her beef tea. You know, right. Otherwise, she will not survive. Right. So that's one crisis. There's another crisis where his second son also falls ill.
Yes.
And is very critically ill. And again, it's the same prescription from the doctors. You have to give him eggs. You have to give him beef tea. Otherwise, he will not survive. Right. And these are posed really as dilemmas, not so much for his wife or for the son, who is a young boy in any case, but it's these are written as crises for Gandhi.
Right.
Right. So exactly. He is the one, you know, who has to choose for them. And he has to demonstrate that his commitment to vegetarianism is so pure, so moral, that he is willing to make the greatest of these sacrifices, which is the sacrifice of his wife, the sacrifice of his son. You know, he's willing to let them die rather than to violate the principles of vegetarianism. And so for him, the greatest good is not necessarily staying alive or right. even keeping your loved ones alive, right? Rather, it's about a certain kind of inexorable hewing to a certain kind of dietary principle. And so I think those stories are really very interesting. And even for Gandhi, they're kind of troubling stories,
yes.
you
yes.
know. And these are not situations where he finds it easy. He finds himself torn, etc. And so I wanted to point to some of the complexities and some of the ambiguities of these forms of dietary self-sacrifice, well, about who it is who is doing the sacrificing.
That's a very intimate story, as we were saying. Those are very right. intimate stories because that does bring the food into the family.
Right.
And you also tell the story about how he says that he learned to fast from his mother.
Yes.
So that seems to me to be also central to our right. discussion. That certainly brings in all the ways in which the identification of ourself with food and with family,
right.
with mother,
right.
What could be more sort of primordial to the right. way that we think about ourselves?
Right.
So that the mother's milk being our preliminary food, but yet, right. as you say, it's a kind of an odd idea to say, what did you learn from your mother? Not eating.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, yes.
And if
yeah.
anything, that shows us, I think, sort of the paradoxical mm-hmm. notion of a lot of things that you're pointing to
right.
are pointing out the tremendous paradoxes.
Right.
around food, and that right. you can't seem to get away from paradoxes
right.
no matter what you do.
Right.
You know, the paradoxes follow in a lot of ways. So we see that intimately there. And then the political fast as well. The one other point I thought, which was extremely interesting, besides these stories about being sick and the stories about learning from his mother fasting, mm-hmm. is the point you make that all vegetarianism is not equal. That for him, he is in many ways a diasporic vegetarian. In other mm-hmm. words, he becomes a vegetarian when he is outside of India
mm-hmm.
and learns about it through almost like the kind of vegetarianism we have in Northern California,
mm-hmm.
which is kind
mm-hmm.
of an elitist, globalized, pick your arugula with local arugula and only eat that
right.
kind of a beautiful notion of vegetarian, which I think is somewhat different. So I think for our listeners, they may never have thought about all vegetarianism seems the same. So maybe you could help us understand a little bit the context of the vegetarianism that he encountered when he was in England and how that differs from the vegetarianism he might have been found more in India at that time.
Right. I mean, he grew up in a vegetarian family. And, you know, when he was a young boy, he tried meat on occasion. And, you know, he did this not so much because he had a taste for meat, but because at that point it was widely believed that meat, you know, essentially built up certain kinds of nationalist muscle, as it were, right? And, you know, if he was going to free India from colonial rule, then he had to be appropriately masculine, eat meat, etc. And so, you know, the war against colonialism or the struggle against colonialism had to be waged in the stomach, with the sinews, with the muscles, etc., right? So body, mind, soul, all of them had to be engaged in that kind of struggle. And so that's why he turned to meat, but he didn't like it, right? And but he believed, you know, as a young man, as a teenager, that it was appropriate and indeed imperative to eat meat in a colonial context because of these kinds of qualities, because right. Of its man-making qualities, as it were.
Which was very widely believed among
very
the British.
Very widely across right. the world.
Even if it was bad meat, even if it was cooked like British
Indeed.
Style.
Indeed.
Just meat in any form.
Yes, it was a magical substance.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, but when he came to Britain, you know, he had vowed to his mother that he would remain vegetarian. That was one of the conditions that she imposed on him before she let him go to Britain as a teenager to study as a barrister in the Inns of Court. But when he came to Britain, he developed a different attitude towards vegetarianism. Now it was no longer just a matter of familial inheritance. It was no longer a matter of just fidelity to his vow to his mother, but it was about a very carefully considered and chosen vegetarianism.
Right.
And so he ran into late Victorian vegetarians in London, in the London Vegetarian Society, as well as in various vegetarian restaurants and so on. He read various tracts on vegetarianism, and this is the moment, and that's sort of a conversion moment for him, right? Where he goes from a vegetarianism that's kind of unthinking to something that is chosen, right? And so the vow then becomes something that he makes his own.
What was the basis of this British vegetarianism? In other words, you know, there's a whole tradition in India, but that's quite different from the British. You would think that vegetarianism in the British context would be, in a certain kind of way, a more radical form of vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. So he's going from sort of a, you know, de facto, we don't, you know, these are the kind of restaurants in my neighborhood that I grew up with, to a much more radical form of vegetarianism, even if it didn't mean changing his habit, because of the context, as you said, meat eating, giving up. It's the same thing like I think of in the ancient Greek culture, where if you didn't eat sacrificial meat, you were very on the outs.
You were an outsider.
Because sacrificial meat was so central to identity there.
Right.
So
right.
This is a case where it's almost a reverse, where vegetarianism is an antisocial, anti-contextual movement.
Right. So, you know, the vegetarians he was involved with, you know, were committed to a great variety of causes, right, that we would think of as radical or utopian. I mean, many of them were pacifists. You know, some of them worked for movements of sexual liberation. Some of them were feminists. Some of them were fierce critics of the empire and so on. And so, you know, Gandhi goes from a context in Western India where vegetarianism is completely normative,
right,
to a context where it is still relatively novel.
Yeah.
It's radical. It's, you know, to do it is to, you know, put yourself under a great deal of pressure. It's to make yourself an outsider and so on. But it's also very interestingly a context where, you know, he comes to be hailed as something of an expert, right? Because he's coming from the land of vegetarianism.
Yes.
He's, you know, he is a lifelong vegetarian. And so for the first time, this very awkward, very clumsy young man, you know, who cannot string together two sentences without, you know, embarrassing himself completely or becoming tongue-tied, suddenly he finds himself hailed as somebody who is an authority, you know, who is asked to speak on these questions and so on. And so that too is part of his making, part of his self-fashioning as the eventual great soul, the Mahatma, and so on.
Right. Well, it's an incredible story if you think about it, because it reminds me of the idea of you only have an accent when you're not at home.
Yeah.
So he leaves the culture. He's completely, and I would argue in many ways, miscategorized and misunderstood in the British society. Yeah. He manages to make something out of it anyway.
Indeed.
He then takes his Britishified form of vegetarianism, goes home with it, and nativizes the diaspora version of vegetarianism.
Right.
So it's incredibly complicated. So, but actually, we have come to the end of our first segment today on Office Hour. So stay with us. We will be back with Palmer Roy to talk more about eating and not eating in Indian literature. So we'll just have some public service announcements first. We'll be right back. So welcome back. We are now in our second segment of Office Hour today, talking with Parama Roy about her book on elementary tracks about food and India and diaspora and modern identity. And we started off with Gandhi. And I thought we could move from there to another chapter in the book, which deals with another, maybe not as famous as Gandhi, right?
One never knows.
But you never know, because we are in Northern California, and I'm sure that many, many people have used Jeffrey's cookbooks. Now, she has many, many of the cookbooks here, mm-hmm. but would you say she is the most well-known in the English genre of Indian cooking? She's certainly well-known in my house. I know we have a couple of her books on cooking. And is that why you chose her in particular to start with her?
Yeah, she probably is still the best known. I mean, now, you know, there's been such a proliferation of cookbooks, you know, on Indian writing, whether in the diaspora or in the subcontinent. But I think she still remains probably the most prolific figure, probably the best known figure. And of course, she's one of the first figures to gain, to capture a certain kind of audience, a certain kind of cosmopolitan audience for Indian cooking, and to have people think of it as a complex and sophisticated cuisine, you know, rather than just some cheap food that, you know, you might get in a takeout, as it were, right?
Exactly.
And she's also, I think, notable for the ways in which she both presents the cuisine as I said, complex, as sophisticated, with a very rich kind of history.
Mm-hmm.
But the cookbooks are also extraordinarily readable.
Yes.
Right?
That's
and
right.
And you were talking earlier in, you know, when you were talking about the section on Gandhi, you were talking about the importance of a certain kind of familial history, right? Which is crucial to understanding the place of food, of digestion, of alimentation, etc. And that is also quite important in Jaffrey, right? And so she will give you, in addition to fairly fabulous recipes, right, she gives you also
family stories.
A family story, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is a very important narrative dimension, right, to these cookbooks, which I think is a very significant part of that kind of appeal.
Right. So let's say we start here, Madhur Jaffrey, that we've got 1973, An Invitation to Indian Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote cookbooks for many years.
Indeed.
She's made years and years, if you think about that, 1973, many, many years of cookbooks. And as you say, they combine, they give us a picture of India that combines recipes with narrative family
mm-hmm.
stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have many friends who run bookstores, and one of the things that's amazing about bookstores is that people will buy, there are two areas in which people buy large numbers of books
uh-huh.
that they don't actually use. One of them is cookbooks and one of them is gardening, you know? So when friends of mine were starting a new bookstore, they were told if you put in a big selection of either cookbooks or gardening, or better yet, both of them,
uh-huh.
that will carry all the other books because of the appetite for that. So I'm interested.
Actually, that's an interesting observation, and it really makes you think about what it means to use a book,
yes.
right? And
yes.
so you know, if I cannot read a cookbook with pleasure, I will not use it. I really don't care what the recipes are like, you know. Yes. And so it has to perform that, you know, that function, you know, of, you know, satisfying, of giving me reading pleasure.
Yes.
First and foremost.
Exactly.
You know, if it's just a selection of recipes, you know, I'm not going to look at it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. So interestingly enough, we would now be placing the cookbook as a subgenre of novel.
Or narrative.
Or narrative, yeah. Right? I mean, in the sense that there is enough plot to vaguely carry
Indeed.
You from section to section.
Indeed.
So we have this whole, and I think what is so interesting for me as in your writing about this is that it becomes then a window mm-hmm. onto a world mm-hmm. in the same way that we travel to Victorian England by reading literature, mm-hmm. that we travel. So here we are traveling both diaspora and homeland. We're all sort of traveling to an India mm-hmm. that then is presented here, as you say, a very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
So she's trying to make an upscale trip,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
an upscale, sophisticated cosmopolitan, and also, much like Gandhi, an internationalized
right.
form
Indeed.
Of Indian cooking. So
Indeed.
Indian cooking takes its place through this woman on the world stage.
Right. Right, exactly. So it's, you know, so this is about, you know, Indian food at its point of arrival, you know, if you will, on an international stage, as you nicely put it. And one of the ways, of course, she's doing it, I mean, of course, part of it is through this certain kind of family narrative and
right.
so on, and the production of, and, you know, producing some very fine recipes. But part of it is also trying to get you to unthink certain things
yes.
about Indian cuisine,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And to unthink certain kind, what she thinks of as certain kinds of stereotypes that have attached to Indian cuisine, right? And so one of her great crusades from early on, you know, starting from 1973, has been to wish away the word curry.
Yes.
That is associated with
okay,
Indian
listeners,
food.
You can no longer use the word curry. It's a lowbrow word. It doesn't represent the complexity of Indian food. So okay.
Well, that's what Jaffrey says. I mean, I'm not necessarily endorsing this.
Okay.
You know, but, you know, so Jaffrey speaks of the way in which the word curry has become a certain kind of stand-in, if you
yes.
will, for Indian cuisine.
And a denigration, stand-in
yeah.
and denigration
yeah,
at the same time.
Yeah, it's a certain kind of trivialization and so on. And so she wants to turn away from this word curry that has become for her inexplicably and unpleasantly popular,
yeah.
you know. And to reintroduce another word, you know, with a different kind, which, you know, has different kinds of resonances. And that word is spices, right?
Right.
And she wants, when she wants us to think about Indian cuisine, she wants us to think about it in terms of spices, right?
Mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm.
terms of their great variety, you know, their various health-giving properties, their complexities, the number of ways in which you can use them, and so on. And in that, she's also speaking to a sort of longer history of the association of the Indian subcontinent and further the East Indies, you know, Indonesia, and so on, with spices, right? And so she's referring here in some ways or indexing an older history of a European fascination with spices,
yes.
right?
So
which goes back to the medieval period.
Right. She's all the way to the kings of the Orient, you know,
right.
that references throughout literature to something. Sometimes it's wisdom that comes from there,
yeah.
and sometimes it's spices. And they
right.
somehow seem to be sort of, you know, tropes on each other.
Right,
you know,
right, right. And you know, spices grow, you know, we are told, you know, near or in the Garden of Eden,
exactly,
right? And so
exactly.
to be around these fragrant things is to be near some kind of paradise, earthly or otherwise, you know.
Exactly.
And so she wants in many ways to bring back that old glamour that attached to spices several mm-hmm. centuries ago.
Now, I would imagine that she would be aware that it's a mixed bag glamour. I mean, I'm quite struck by that. For one thing, Americans generally have a fairly, there are two things about it. One is that Americans generally have a fairly pale palate. So the question is, who is she talking to? I can't see my sort of middle American family relatives who are that spice to them is something that you say no thank you to. And the second thing is it does kind of orientalize in the traditional indeed. Sense of orientalizing.
Indeed.
It commits you to being part of a mystique that mm-hmm. comes with a negative side as well. So
oh,
I don't know.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is inseparable, you know, from a certain kind of self-orientalizing, right?
Yes.
Only this time it is in the name of a certain kind of authenticity. So curry is not authentic, right?
Spices
whereas spices are authentic, but it is, you know, every bit is invested in nostalgia, you know, and authenticity itself, you know, is not something that we can detach from Orientalism, if
mm-hmm,
you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there is very much that kind of risk that she takes, you know, as part of the price of entry, if you will, right, into a global culinary stage.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that it may also be part of the reason why she's so successful, right? Because it is a language that, you know, in a sense is familiar, right? We are aware of the glamour of spices,
yes.
even if we may not necessarily want them on our plate all the time.
That is
but
true.
But it is a familiar language. It's a resonant language and we respond to it.
Mm-hmm. And it points towards something which also becomes in some ways possible to value, which is differentiation,
yeah.
ethnicity,
right.
Italians. You know, we in other words, when we go out to dinner in America, that might be a moment at which we revel in the non-melting
right.
part aspect of the world, that
right.
there's something that's appealing to us by
right.
the fact that these people use these spices and these
right.
people don't use these spices,
right.
almost in a... I don't know whether you have some thoughts about what is so appealing about that, because it does. It's the other half from the melting pot, which is that somehow we all want to have a communality around our food. But
mm-hmm.
yet in some ways, one of the things we look for when we go to a cookbook store is the food that seems the farthest from the familiar food.
Right. Well, I mean, your use of the term melting pot is interesting, right? And
right.
I just think of all the different kinds of culinary metaphors that have been used to describe the United States,
yes.
right? And the arrival of different kinds of people from across the world to its shores, right? And melting pot is one way to think about it, but, you know... the constant updates, right, on that culinary metaphor. So I've also heard of the salad bowl, right?
Okay.
So you have things that are tossed together, all these different elements that are tossed together, but that
yes.
do not necessarily melt into one, right?
Yes.
And so it's a certain kind of, you know, diversity and proximity at the same
mm-hmm.
time,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think, you know, both of these impulses are very much at stake in the cookbooks that we read, the foods that we might seek to eat either at restaurants or to try in our own homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's we seek both, you know, a certain kind of proximity, right?
Mm-hmm.
A certain kind of amalgamation, but we also seek difference,
mm-hmm.
right? And it seems to be one of the easier ways in which we can deal with difference, it
yes.
seems.
Salad bowl is used quite a bit now in the study of comparative religion, current
yeah.
religion, because the
okay.
idea is that the rituals end up having a little bit of this and a little
right.
bit of that,
right.
and a lot
right.
of weddings are what
right.
we call salad bowls. And
right.
you don't call the wedding the melting pot, because
right.
somehow that just doesn't sound
right.
good for
right.
a wedding,
right.
but you could have the idea of a salad bowl. And since we've talked...
And it also gives you something of the ad hoc character of it.
Right,
yeah.
throw in whatever you
yeah.
have, right?
right,
whatever you have.
Yeah.
And maybe never made quite exactly the same each
right.
time, too.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that takes us back to the points we were making about Gandhi,
uh-huh.
Which is, again, the intimacy of this. Because
right.
Another way of looking at this sort of psychologically, and there's a lot of psychological points very, very close to the surface in a lot of your chapters, it is sort of what we might call a compromise formation
mm-hmm.
between refusing the mother, learning to fast from the mother, and learning to take in from the mother.
Mm-hmm.
That it, so it is sort of a compromise between
right.
all of the complexities we feel in the family, both
right.
wanting inside the family and outside
right.
the family. Because
right.
after all, interestingly enough, if you think about it, the point of a cookbook is that you can make something foreign, right? If it was too foreign, I mean, you pick up a foreign cookbook, there's nothing more annoying than picking up a foreign cookbook that is so wacky you can't possibly make anything. Mm-hmm. We travel a lot, and occasionally we open it up. You don't understand the measurements. You mm-hmm. don't understand anything mm-hmm. there. You know, nobody wants to buy that cookbook.
Right.
People want to buy the cookbook that transforms, translates, the cookbook as the translator. I see them as being sort of like cultural translators, like a Google translator.
Right, right. No, you're absolutely right. At the same time, you know, I want to add as a supplement to this, but that sometimes we also are looking for the familiar, right? And so when you pick up a cookbook, it's about the kinds of stuff that maybe your mother used to cook, but, you know, that she never wrote down, right?
Yes.
And so this is given to you and rendered, you know, into something else, right? As a result of this kind of translation. So even the familiar, in a sense, can be translated, right? Which
yes.
is why you also have, you know, the fondness for, you know, very homey kinds of dishes now, mac
yes.
and cheese, things you ate as a kid. Comfort foods, etc. So there's, I think, an interesting and continual oscillation, right, between the poles of the unfamiliar and the familiar, right?
Right.
And the ways in which the familiar itself, you know, can be rendered strange, it can be rendered sophisticated,
yes.
it can be rendered into something more complicated than just the cooking of your mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think about that sort of a parallel there between how canons work in religion
mm-hmm.
and how cookbooks work. Because, for example, we picked up, you know, 101 chocolate chip cookie recipes.
Okay.
So here you have the selection down, and this is, you know, Jonathan Smith's theory of canon, uh-huh. That canon means you select down to a certain object or number of objects,
right.
and then you try to make as many things as you can out of potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So you select down to the chocolate chip cookie, and then you try to make as many variations
right.
on it as possible. And that this speaks very deeply to something that we feel as humans about the idea of selection and creativity.
Right.
That we don't always go out and get cookbooks that are just things we don't usually eat.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see, certainly we don't see that in terms of cuisine, which is
mm-hmm.
finding new things to do with familiar items. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you, would you say, make a broad, huge sort of theoretical contrast between those moments when we are sort of doing canon and then explication, and those moments when we actually want to go outside of the canon,
mm-hmm.
when we actually want to go instead of another book on more ways of making chocolate chip cookies,
mm-hmm.
that sometimes we are also wanting to break out of the canon.
Right.
And we want to go to something that feels very far
right.
from the culture.
Of course, of course. You know, as you spoke of it as a form of traveling, which I think is a nice way to do that, right? I mean, it's one way in which we can think of ourselves as cosmopolitan, as citizens of the world, right? As
mm-hmm.
participants to a certain degree in what seems to us to be unfamiliar, right? And
mm-hmm.
food becomes one of the most obvious vectors. And you can do it, of course, through going to a restaurant, you can do it through eating, you can do it just through reading.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you don't even have to, I mean, if your palate is a very delicate or unadventurous one, you know, it does not have to be disturbed in any way.
Exactly. Now,
yeah.
we are letting our listeners in on a secret. Many, many people buy cookbooks and don't cook out of them. So don't feel bad if you never made a single thing out of one of your cookbooks. But what would you say that this question about sort of selection and how does this fit into what we would call modernity? Do you think there's a particular issue around these with, and also post-colonial modernity, which is very much sort of a central theme in the book? And I'm not sure how food plays in particular ways around that question.
Yeah. Well, that's a very broad question you're asking. And, you know, and if I can step back just a second to speak about what made me write this book in
mm-hmm.
the first place. And that brings me to the question of modernity, which, and, you know, one reason, you know, I became interested in writing this book is because As a scholar of postcolonial studies, as a scholar of the British Empire, I had been thinking for a long time and reading the scholarship on what the colonial contact zone is,
right.
You know, on what it means to encounter difference, on the forms through which difference is negotiated, you know, and established or undone, etc. And most scholars that I was aware of thought of this process of colonial encounter as something that occurred on a plane that was intellectual, on a plane that was affective, and so on. But it seemed to me sort of critically important to think of this encounter as not just something that was about the transformation of minds and souls, right? But that was also importantly body shaping, if you will, right? So something that had very much an embodied effect. So I wanted really to think about the ways in which the colonial encounter was intensely embodied, right? Mm-hmm. And it was not just about the remaking of the ways in which you thought about the world, right? But also the ways in which you thought about your body, the ways in which, you know, new appetites were formed, uh-huh. You know, new forms of taste, new forms of disgust, new forms of, you know, managing your body, you
right.
know, or civilizing your body, you know, producing your body as a certain kind of modern subject. You know, appropriately embodied subject. You know, how did that happen? So food seemed to me a good way to enter into those kinds of questions.
So what you're saying is that once you've had the colonial experience, you'll never eat the same.
Yes,
is that a way of thinking about it?
Yeah, because, you know, colonialism is an encounter with modernity. Right. It is the interface with modernity. Yes. And so. You are remade, I mean, not just, as I said, in your mind or in your soul, but in your gut, as it were.
Yes.
Right? And it's not only the colonized, it's also the colonizer. And
Absolutely.
That is something I want to insist upon. So it's on either side of the colonial divide, you know, these tastes and appetites and desire and forms of disgust are being remade all the time. And often in ways that you don't expect.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that you have another very interesting chapter about the very close relationship during the colonial period of what the British ate when they were living in India.
Yeah.
And one can only think about that when we go to Scotland, and as you say today, when we go to England, and everybody makes a, you know, a beeline for the Indian restaurants.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've seen the entire cycling going around. Mm-hmm. Now, those restaurants, maybe we have nothing that is left in whatever, if we ever had a notion of anything ever being authentic. We certainly lived now in a post-authentic world, because we live in the world in which both the colonial, the post-colonial, it's all been mixed up and remade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what modernity is then? Is that how we characterize? Well, how would we characterize even the stories we've told today? They're hard to characterize. Gandhi going and getting vegetarianism from England, taking it back, and that becoming Indian vegetarian, that going back to England then. So it's almost like the transmigration of souls. It's awfully hard to sort of characterize what you're, you know, Joffrey was an actress as mm-hmm. well as a, mm-hmm. so here she is in England mm-hmm. making BBC documentaries
right.
about spice.
Right.
Yeah. It's very hard to even sort of characterize how complex that is, to kind of get a handle on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, modernity is in so many ways, it hinges on certain notions of autonomy and choice, right? On certain kinds of, choices being made, right? With respect to diet, with respect to abstinence, with respect to bodily comportment, with respect to civilized bearing, etc., right? And when we think about modernity, I mean, that is one of its most important inflections, right? So modernity is, involves a certain kind of departure from tradition, where, you know, and this is a caricature of tradition I'm presenting here, where, you know, this is something inherited, that is something that is received and something that you repeat, as it were, right, as a matter of filial loyalty or whatever, right? And modernity is so often associated with certain forms of choice, freedom, autonomy, self-making, etc., right? And that is something of a story, right, in these kinds of chapters.
Yes.
So Gandhi is taking a certain prohibition that has been laid upon him by his mother.
And doing it by choice.
Saying, this is my choice. Right. I chose it.
And I'm doing it my way.
Exactly.
It's Frank Sinatra writ large.
Exactly.
Who would have thought Frank Sinatra is ushering us into the modern world?
I never thought I'd hear Sinatra and Gandhi in the same breath. But they make an interesting couple.
Yes. And then if I would say something that to me struck me as being quite traditional, actually was the charges of cannibalism. In a certain kind of way, what was interesting to me was seeing that the same old fears of a cannibalism that went back into the ancient world are still just picked up in modernity. And so maybe that says something about how deeply rooted our concern about who we're eating are, both, you know, as a cannibalism being, you know, the Freudian sense of the ambivalence holding hate and love together, that we both want to devour people because they're so yummy and we love them so much, but also we hate them so much. And that some kind of way that stays with us as a kind of a dark fear. We had this story in the British example of the charging that an Indian servant had cut up by a British. You know, that's the worst thing that happened. A Brit would be cut up and fed to somebody else.
Sliced up into joints and placed on tables.
On tables. So you know, maybe it's kind of a dark moment to sort of end the interview on, but we do find these fears around food and the complex of cannibalism, which seems to me quite familiar.
Indeed, indeed. You know, you had started by saying that at the end of this, you will have an appetite for your dinner. Well, perhaps, you know, or perhaps not, as it were, because certainly, you know, so much of what I write about is disgust.
Yes.
And avoidance. And of course, some of these tropes that you're talking about, cannibalism, which, of course, has a very, very, very long history going back to Herodotus, etc., and, you know, existing into the present day, constantly recycled in a number of different kinds of contexts.
Well, but one could argue in this case, you can't have disgust without having also appetite.
Of course.
That they are two
course.
Aspects of the
course.
Same thing.
Indeed.
So that you always have to have the thing that you don't eat. And you also have... you know, and I realize, again, this is a large question, but the notion behind cannibalism of the symbolic value of food. So maybe what we would say then in relationship to what you've been saying about modernity is that part of the symbolic value is, again, this idea of choice, that's kind of the symbol. I'm not sure exactly what cannibalism and how cannibalism and choice fit together. I haven't thought about that. But
yeah, well, yeah, I mean... I think of, I can't bring cannibalism and modernity quite together. I mean, so cannibalism seems to have such a long temporal life, you know. It's not just accommodable within the orbit of modernity.
Well, that's a very powerful statement, because it does speak, as Obi Sekere talks about, to some of our deepest wishes and our fears.
Indeed.
So it may be that even choice doesn't displace that basic disgust and appetite that then goes back to, because oddly enough, we still start the world with the family, that we still start with the food being the intimate connection in the family situation. And given that, it's always going to have with it all the concerns about what you get literally from your mother, the milk you get, the way in which your mother both feeds you and doesn't feed you, and the way in which eating your mother has from the get-go, as you say, a kind of symbolic overtone, and that's just going to stay with us no matter what other cultural contexts float around on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, the notion of choice is itself, you know, something of a red herring, if you will, right?
Yes.
I mean, all these stories tell us about the degrees, the degree to which we retain this illusion of choice, even, you know, as we know, right, that how we ingest, what we ingest, with whom we eat, etc., does not necessarily happen in conditions of our own making.
Okay, so just remember that when you go out to the restaurant tonight, you think you'll have 100 choices, but your choices are still delineated. So thank you so much. We've come to the end of the hour, and I wanted to thank you so much. If you want to listen to this, it will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com. You can listen to this show and other shows on our archive. We'll be back next week with another show. In the meantime, thank you very much for coming on tonight.
Thank you, Naomi. I enjoyed this.